Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Hey, and welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, Tuesday, 3 p.m. Thanks for listening in. We have a great show today. First time actually on air, not calling in from UK, London, Carl Warner. You don't know who he is? Oh, you've seen his work. Foodscapes, food landscapes, these amazing architectural feats of photography, pretty much inclusive of food as ingredients, food as all art elements in the image. We'll get back to that in a second. Just want to introduce Carl, whose background actually was born in Liverpool, England, and still to this day works in London, correct?
That's right, yeah. I live down in Kent in south of England. Travel up to my studio every day, which is about 40 minutes into London. But yeah, originally from Liverpool, although I don't talk like a Liverpoolian anymore.
No, I don't even know the differentiation in accent. What is it?
Well, if you're from Liverpool, you probably talk a bit like this, like the Beatles, yeah. You know, like John Lennon, you know.
But you can still pull the wool over people's eyes.
Yes, yeah, I throw myself in and out of that.
Excellent. Now, you ended up going to art school for drawing initially, and now work as a photographer.
Yeah, I was very blessed with the ability to draw as a kid. And I was an only child and spent sort of hours in my bedroom drawing, listening to music, and kind of inventing little worlds, I suppose, in my head and on paper. And just kind of practicing drawing was a really good thing. I think a lot of people have got the ability to draw a bit, but if you kind of do a lot of it, you get better at it. And the kind of work I'm doing now is almost like an extension of that. I've created these sort of worlds out of food through photography that really have sort of started off from my imagination, or the muscle of my imagination, yeah, being exercised from a very young age.
Well, it's also a little part and due to your inspirations. Quoted Salvador Dali, Patrick Woodruff, who did a lot of Judith Priest cover art.
Did he? I don't remember seeing those.
I remember seeing a couple of those. And record sleeve artists such as Roger Dean and Hypnosis, which is Storm Thurgeson's studio.
Yeah.
And if you don't know their work, it ranges from Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon to Led Zeppelin to even books like Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So imagine, those kind of fantastical worlds. Well, Carl is doing that with food. It's quite outstanding. And I mean, you said that you spent hours drawing and listening to the music. was it of these bands, like Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin?
Yeah, very much so. I was really into kind of, I don't know, early Genesis and Yes and all those things. They're very unpopular with my wife.
Well, like Peter Gabriel?
Yeah. Big fan of Peter Gabriel.
Me too.
Yeah.
So are you Peter or Phil?
I was both, actually. Yeah. I was originally, you know, Peter, but I liked the early, the trick of the tail and the stuff that started off when Phil was still kind of trying to be a bit like Peter. Yeah. I thought that was okay. It was when they went off the rails and did all kinds of silly
Hopefully
things.
Hopefully Phil isn't listening in on this show.
I hope not.
Steaming. So you listened to a lot of these albums, was inspired by the album covers and the art therewith. What was that transition then in art school that took you away from drawing into photography?
Well, I found that when I got to art school, there were some guys who were really good at drawing. I mean, I thought I was quite good and this was my future. But when I saw how well these guys drew on, I just thought, oh, no, I'm a bit outranked here.
Oh, I've seen your sketches in your book. You're doing just fine.
They were kind of, they take a long time to do. And I saw this guy starting doing a drawing at the beginning of the week. And by the end of the week, you could see he was bored. He was still sketching it in and making a leather jacket look almost photographic. And I thought, he's putting so much effort into that. And during that time, okay, he's done a great picture at the end of it, but he had one picture to show for it. Whereas I'd shot 20 rolls of film. I had printed kind of, you know, 50 prints. And I had so much more. It was so much more prolific. I kind of found that, wow, photography is faster, quicker, easier, I suppose. But also it was a medium that enabled me to develop ideas and be creative in a shorter time span and learn so much more.
So it was kind of about being frenetic rather than just, you know, sitting there working on technique.
Yeah. And I think it just helps, you know, as the mind or the imagination as a muscle to a creative muscle to use to flex it. And it's like going to gym. I found that photography was the sort of gym of the sort of creative experience for me. And I was just in love with the fact that I loved the fact that I could take photographs of things and make the mundane look a bit more interesting by the use of lighting or printing or composition. And that's kind of what I got into doing. I sort of moved into the advertising world because of that, being able to make a boring everyday object look beautiful.
Yeah. And you assisted for a lot of ad photographers.
Not that many. I assisted for about a year, but this was back in the 80s when there was so much work around. I mean, you just put your hat out the window and then layout would fall into it. And a lot of the design companies were and PR agencies were also commissioning because the photo libraries in those days were really poor. They were really very kind of average kind of work that was in it. So everybody was wanting photography commissioned. Not so now, sadly.
Yeah. We'll jump ahead from the 80s to 2008. I guess it was kind of a fateful day. January 13th, 2008. Carl had a quarter page spread in the Sunday Times about his food landscapes. The next day, the Daily Mail, the Mirror, the Sun, BBC, and appearance on the Richard and Judy show.
Yes, yeah.
And that was it.
That was a good day.
Yeah. That is a fantastic day.
Yeah.
And then what kind of inquiries, what kind of things started coming into the studio?
Well, I got a lot of people obviously wanting to interview me, lots of magazines and newspapers, and that kind of coupled with the internet where people had started to sort of download the pictures and put them together in PDFs and send them, you know, viral global emailing all over the place was just kind of happening behind, you know, the scenes. I didn't realize it was all going on. And of course, all of these people, I was getting emails from South America and China just saying, you know, we really love what you're doing and stuff. And I was just really overwhelmed, you know, very kind of, I feel very, you know, privileged to be able to do something like this. But my career was not particularly on an upward trajectory at that time.
Yeah.
And this kind of just turned my world round.
Do you celebrate that day every year?
I should do. Actually, I haven't thought about doing that, but I ought to, for sure.
Well, why did you even do that project? It wasn't commissioned. It was
no. I mean, I think being in the advertising world and working as a creative photographer, you need to kind of offer up work to the ad agencies, a particular style, a way of looking at something, a technique, just so that they'll kind of, you know, throw a job your way and think, well, that'd be great for selling this product or that. So that was the way I was keeping in business, really, was just by kind of pitching ideas to agencies. So this whole foodscape thing started from me trying to do something different and original. And I went out one day to a food market and just came across these fantastic portobello mushrooms that were beautiful specimens. They hadn't, you know, no blemishes or anything. And the fronds were all kind of, is it fronds, the underside of a mushroom? Anyway, they were all just beautiful and perfect. So I kind of brought them back to the studio with a view of photographing them. But I couldn't get away from the fact that these look like trees.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to try and make this look like they are trees on a very small, very simple tabletop to create this three-dimensional world. And that is the image that's featured at the beginning of the book, which is kind of, you know, the opening kind of one that I did. And that's that was how it started, really, and I've kind of moved it on from there. I didn't really think I had many more ideas. I thought that was it.
Yeah, I actually have Carl's book in front of me, Food Landscapes by, is it Abrams Books?
Abrams Books,
just came out October 2010. Check it out. You can get it wherever books are sold. And I was told possibly not outer space. I'm not sure if they have a reseller out there, but if you're out in outer space, ask for the book and maybe they'll pick it up. But yeah, I'm looking through this book. Initially, you study the image and sometimes don't even realize what the elements of the image are. Like you said, mushrooms being trees. But I mean, it's even past that. What's amazing is that he has these almost shot lists, but they're actually labeled as ingredients, where he conceptualizes a shoot. The second one in the book is the salmon sea, where it says sea equals smoked salmon. Rocks are dark soda bread. Sand and pebbles are sugar and pinto beans. Foreground rocks are new potatoes and parsley. Foreground trees are dill. The boat is pea pod with a bean sprout. The sky is a side of salmon. I mean, aside from some of the larger elements, you know, I didn't realize that they were pinto beans. I didn't realize that it was actually salmon at first. You've turned food into some amazing textural abstract thing.
Yeah, I mean, I call it the pleasant deception. It's I love it when people look at the work. First of all, they think it's a real scene, and I'm intentionally trying to fool them into thinking that it's real. And then the double take when they actually realize it's all made out of food, you know, they always end up smiling. It's a really nice kind of reaction. And it's something which inspires people. I kind of think these days everything's kind of been done is being reinvented all the time. To actually come across something that's new and original and different is quite, I think, you know, good for people to see that there are not everything's yet been done, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, but what's amazing too, it's not that you're using, you know, broccoli as a tree. You're actually thinking about regionality. He has a series of kind of Tuscan landscapes, which use a lot of implements of Tuscan cuisine in the photo rather than...
Yeah, that's very important to me. I think if I'm photographing a particular place, it's only right that I use the ingredients from that place. It somehow fits together well. I mean, I think that landscape is altered or manipulated by man in terms of how he farms the land, and the kind of things that grow on the land are obviously, you know, what they end up eating in those areas. So there's this wonderful link between food and landscape, which you know, which the work is celebrating, really. And I'm quite fascinated by the link between things, especially as the larger things in the planet are kind of also echoed in the smaller things. You know, okay, on a simple level, a broccoli spear does look like a tree.
Yeah.
But I didn't think there were many other things out there, but I've kind of discovered that the textures and the colors and the detail in certain small ingredients, you know, really do resemble those of larger things. And I'm kind of playing on that illusion, but also, you know, with my interest in food, I'm kind of connecting it to something that's about a particular place, a particular location.
Listen, let's talk about your interest in food. You know, there's that preconception about what British food is here in the United States. Mm-hmm. What did you eat growing up?
Well, you know, being from up north in England, that's where you had meat and two veg.
Yeah.
So the meat and two veg is what you got on your plate. Always some form of potato, boiled mashed potato, chips, whatever, and meat and a bit of greens. There wasn't English cuisine in the 1970s when I grew up wasn't the best food in the world, and we hadn't really been introduced to Chinese food and Indian food and you know, Italian food. It was just starting to filter its way through at that point. So for me, for where I was and where I was living, and just the people around me. We weren't really eating food in the same way as we do today. So it was very uninspiring. And I'm not, I mean, I love food and I'm a big foodie, but, you know, my work is more of a celebration of food rather than through photography and through these visions that I have in my weird mind that helps me bring around these ideas and bring them to fruition in terms of creating a piece of art. That's, yeah.
Well, you had also mentioned before that you went to the market and, you know, picked up a portobello. Any specific market? Does it happen to be like London's Borough Market?
Or? Well, my studio now is just a stone's throw from Borough Market.
Yeah, that's good inspiration.
That is a great place to go to. You've been there?
No, I haven't. I've seen tons and tons of pictures.
All right. It's, I mean, compared to, you know, like New York, I mean, everything here is just so much bigger and more colourful and more exciting. We've got a few little places like Borough Market that are very sweet. I mean, it's a lovely old place and it's got all the history there. It is, in fact, the oldest market, I think, in England, to be honest, because it's right next to London Bridge. It's where the Romans first put a pontoon bridge across the River Thames, and the market set up there and the first settlement set up there, which was eventually named by the Romans as Londinium, and that's where it all began. So that is a very old market, but it's great to walk around, and they've got all the kind of different sort of fruit and vegetables and all the seasonal stuff that comes in. And I never tire of kind of going there and having a look, and the sights and the tastes of everything is just wonderful.
Yeah, what do vendors know you there now as, the food scape guy?
No, I wish they did. Perhaps they would be a little bit more kind of like, wouldn't charge me so much.
Yeah.
Now, we do talk about kind of perhaps putting some of the pictures up there, because I am sort of like, some people realize, and some people say, oh, you know, you're a local artist that does this food thing. So I'd like to sort of get some of my pictures up on the wall there. But yeah, I kind of, sometimes it's nice to just kind of, I mean, I go to say, oh, look, I'm trying to make this mountain out of steak. Have you got anything, or what can we make? And they just look like me, like I'm crazy. And I kind of say, well, you know, I have to show a picture, and they go, yeah. Oh, right. Because when I say to people, they say, well, what do you do? And I say, oh, I make landscapes out of food. And they go, what? Well, that sounds, what do you mean you make landscapes? I said, and I show them, and they go, oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, did they originally think it's like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you know, with that mashed potato scene where I think.
Yes, yeah, where he's in his kitchen and he's got the bin, he's getting
this
serious.
Means something.
Yes, that is just it. Yeah. I've just taken it to another level.
Exactly. Yeah. Move past the mashed potato and to the meat mountains, meat sculptures, did you just say?
Meat mountains, yeah. I've done, there's a shot in the back of the book, which because Abrams, being an American publisher, they wanted to get some American pictures in there. So I kind of drew upon my memory of old Westerns when I was a kid, and this other one here is the kind of streamline trailer?
Airstream.
Yeah. That's what I was trying
to. I'm looking at the cereal dust bowl image.
Yeah, and again, if you look at the sky is actually a big slab of steak. And these are, what do you call these, Slim Jims, are they?
Yep, exactly.
So telegraph poles made from, out of Slim Jims, and the ground is all cereals and you know, bread and meat, and so it's the kind of Midwest sort of, you know, cereal and, you know, the meat. It's kind of like what's eaten there, you know, what grows there and stuff. So it's very important to me that, you know, again, I tied in those ingredients to create that image.
Yeah, it's an amazing new twist on terroir in imagery.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic. Clients, I mean, this is must have garnered you some work with some food companies.
Yeah, it has, and I kind of, I'm not against prostituting myself to be able to sustain my art and my living and feed my family off the back of being commissioned by people to, you know, to sell food products. I mean, there's some great food products out there. I did a series for an Italian salami company called Negroni, who commissioned, came to me and said, would you be able to make Italian scenes just using our meat products, which I didn't think was going to be possible. But we, as long as we had the bread in there, I put ciabatta bread and we had some breadsticks and things, and I was able to create images using just two simple sets of ingredients. but and they're a bit weird. I mean, they're kind of vegetarian nightmares, I think somebody once described them as. But for me, that's it challenges me to do something that works, but using just a very simple palette. It's very monotone as well, with just sort of pinks and reds of meat, but yet they actually somehow have worked.
Yeah, oddly Christmassy.
Oddly Christmassy as well. Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk a little more to Carl about what his studio smells like, because I'm sure you're all wondering. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with the virally famous Carl Warner, foodscape photographer extraordinaire. And we just left off kind of talking about, you know, how these shoots come together. But I'd like to know a little bit more about your studio, the equipment that you use, but more specifically, the smell. I mean, how long does it take to actually construct one of these sets?
Well, it all depends on the size and scale of them. If we're doing something that's kind of roly-poly hills, we're kind of normally carve those out of polystyrene, first of all, and then we'll cover them with food and dress them. And if we're working with a lot of fresh ingredients, especially fresh herbs, they wilt very quickly.
Yeah.
They die under the light. So we quite often shoot the scenes in sections. So I'll do the foreground first, which will probably take a day just to do a foreground. Shoot it, and then we'll move on to the middle ground and then the background. Obviously, by the time you finish the background, the foreground is just nothing.
So, an element of post-production to sew all these things together.
But everything is, for me, it's very important that it's all shot in front of a static camera that's locked down. Everything has to be in the right place in the frame so that the lighting and the perspective and the scale and the depth of the picture work. So, although we do put things together in Photoshop, they're put together just as elements, but the elements that are all shot for real. Some things take just a day, and some things we have to work quickly with because of the smell. In particular, the fishscape, which is in the book, which is made entirely of fish and seafood. I'm very fortunate in some ways and very unfortunate in other ways, in the fact that I don't have a sense of smell anymore. It's actually disappeared, and it's not through substance abuse. It's just something that's kind of happened inside of my head. I can still taste things. But I cannot smell things, and it's a great shame. I used to have a problem with, you could blindfold me and put a banana under my nose, and when I could smell, like, oh yeah, I know this is obvious.
Yeah.
I know this is, and I just couldn't tell you. And of course, when I see it, of course it's a banana, but my brain wouldn't connect.
So, I mean, that was interesting because Carl was telling me that he had lost his sense of smell prior to us taping this show. And I thought of it, oh, maybe it's Darwinism, because you do have to spend a week on a shoot sometimes with fish sitting out. But at the same time, he mentioned, well, you know, sometimes when you lose one sense, it heightens another. So maybe the kind of visual, the aesthetic of food is that much more pronounced for you now.
Yeah, I kind of think that... I mean, I don't know, I'm visually aware so much, you know, everything I'm doing is about looking and seeing, and so perhaps it's just something I'm not using enough, but I must miss out a lot. I do miss out on aromas and things within and taste related, you know, the sense of smell does affect your sense of taste, it must do. But yes, it is a blessing. And on that particular occasion with the fishscape, I mean, I think everybody went home stinking of fish. And I was actually picked up by my son from the station at about midnight. And I got off the train and I got into the car and he immediately just wound the windows down and was hanging his head out saying, "Oh my God, Dad, you stink."
Yeah,
you know?
How much fish did you get? I'm looking at a picture right now of you.
There's about, in terms of monetary value from the markets, there's about £1,500 worth of fish. That's what, about $2,500 worth of fish and crabs and lobsters and whole sides of salmon. I mean, huge amount of fish.
And it was all from the Billingsgate fish market.
That's right, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, and what kind of fish did you actually get?
It varies. It's all sustainable fish. We obviously been very, because it was for a client as well, we need to make sure that we weren't putting sort of flatfish or cod and things like that. So a lot of herring, sea bass, mackerel, sprats, whitebait.
Pollock. Is
pollock,
it?
Coley, yeah.
What's coley?
Coley is very similar to pollock.
So imitation crab.
No, it's like a white fish. It's just got a white kind of cod-like fish.
Yeah.
In fact, I think they tend to use, a lot of the fish and chip shops in England tend to use pollock and coley now and don't tell the customers that it's not cod because, you know, it's cheaper and, in fact, it's a lovely fish.
And it's more sustainable now.
Yeah, too right. Yeah, that's a very important aspect to it. But people don't, you know, they can't trade descriptions if they're selling cod and it's really pollock. But years ago, we used to, I remember in the 70s, people used to eat scampi. And scampi was supposed to be prawns. And in actual fact, they were using monkfish. And of course, then when monkfish became very popular, I mean, if you were getting little pieces of monkfish in batter, you were doing really well. But it was this sort of poor man's prawn in those days because people couldn't tell the difference. And it was just like, you know, fishy substance inside batter. So, as the fish become sort of go up and down in terms of expense from the sea, it's interesting how we kind of adapt the way we sell things and how we, you know, our awareness of what we're eating.
Yeah. Back to your studio. I mean, to kind of hold all this stuff too, is it a large studio? Is there a kitchen? Is there a walk-in fridge?
I mean, I hire in fridges if I've got a lot of stuff that needs to be refrigerated. I mean, if we did a shoot recently with a lot of meats which we needed to keep cool, I've got two very big fridges in the studio, and we have a kitchen area. It's not a massive studio, it's a sort of still life studio. It's about 1,500 square feet, but with my model makers and my food stylists and food and blocks of polystyrene and cameras and lights, it soon gets filled up.
So, how many people do you have on staff?
It depends on how quickly, like with the fish one, we had to get it all done in a day because of the smell and things rotting and stuff. So we had about six people in the set that day. So there'd be a food stylist, her assistant, model maker, his assistant, me, my assistant. And I think we had a couple of other people on hand as well, just to be washing and clearing up and stuff. So all hands on deck for something like that. Yeah.
And what you said, you use a stationary camera. What kind of camera?
I use a Hasselblad, which has got a sort of a digital back. It's a 39 million pixel chip, one that I have at the moment. I think you can get 60 million at the moment, but I can't tell the difference. It's good enough for me, and we can blow it up into big prints and on billboards and stuff. So, you know, I'm happy as Larry with that. But what's interesting, I've been kind of moving the work into the moving image as well, and even using sort of stills, layered still shots, and then animating them to create sort of we've done various television ads, and I've been doing little films with some of the shots that I've made. So I've been directing sort of TV commercials, and we're now working on a really interesting project, which is to actually kind of take this forward into a kids' animation, which is going to help educate children about healthy eating and where things come from and how they grow and how good they are for you. So it's for me a great privilege to be able to take the work forward into something that could actually do some good.
Yeah.
And I'm very keen to sort of follow the whole sort of Jamie Oliver idea of trying to change some of the food culture that we have, you know, certainly in the UK and in the US as well.
Are you two going to have a syndicate show here in the US?
That would be lovely. Yeah. You know, but
I'll see what I can do.
He hasn't called me yet, you know. Yeah. Maybe he will.
Excellent. And what's the name of the show?
The actual the animation thing yet to be decided for its the actual title of it. I can't give you that yet,
yeah.
But I can't give too many secrets away at the moment.
I'll keep on, okay. You know, wishing and wanting.
Well, it's about a few characters who are going to be traveling through this world of food. So I'm going to be making real food landscapes. The characters will probably be CGI because it's just so costly and time consuming to do them out of stop frame animated kind of models. But they're going to be going through a real world of food and finding out about ingredients, and we're going to make characters out of, you know, like a carrot giraffe, and
yeah,
who can see for miles because you can, you know, your carrots help you see well, and all of the little stories, and there's going to be music,
yeah,
and there's going to be,
but see, know, that's what I love about your work, because it's fantastical, but it's also got this duality to it, where, as you know, a giraffe made of carrots can see because carrots help you see,
yeah.
It's not just, you know, well, this looks like a giraffe, and that's why I'm going to make it a giraffe.
No, it's very important to me that there's a backstory.
Yeah.
Yeah, there has to be a backstory. There has to be a reason for it. I think anything, really, that anybody does in life, if you've got certain kind of passion and certain belief in what you're doing, and it's not just a shallow, superficial, just making pretty pictures out of food, to me, there's a lot more to it. I'm really interested in the whole kind of movement for better eating, better kind of quality of life through diet. And food culture, I think, is something that really needs to be addressed. And there's a lot of great people out there doing a lot of great things, but there's still a long way to go. And I think it's important for me to try and help this kind of idea propagate a little bit more. I really believe, I mean, I have a family of 4 children.
Yeah.
Sitting around the table eating a meal together is really important. My wife and I love cooking, and so our kids see us cooking, and they're, what have you got there? Why, you know, what's going on here? And taste this, try this. And it brings families to the table. And so it's not just a quick pit stop for a fuel intake. It's something that is a celebration of family. It's a time spent together. And, you know, you go to France, you go to Italy, Spain, countries around the Mediterranean, they are all doing this.
Yeah.
And there's a wider sense of community on the back of it as well, because everybody loves food. They all celebrate, you know, and you go to Spain and they'll make a massive paella,
yeah,
and feed the village, you know. I mean, we don't have that in England. I've seen in the States they have massive cookouts and big sort of barbecue kind of things and stuff like that, but on a small scale, on a local scale, communities, villages, towns, just kind of suburban areas could actually kind of get together a bit more over food.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a good thing.
Do you feed a village with your sets after you're done?
I could do,
yeah.
Yes, I could. we tend to share out the food after we've shot. I mean, some people do kind of have a pot shot at me about what a waste of food. I don't believe my work is a waste of food just because it's not being eaten. I think that it's bringing a lot of joy, and if it's certainly being used as a vehicle for nutritionalists and in children's hospitals to encourage children to start eating after they've been ill, childhood obesity clinics, all kinds of people are interested in using the imagery in order to, you know, put across healthy food, a healthy eating message.
And, yeah, I think of it like sacrificial lamb. I mean, it's a small sacrifice to pay to educate and, you know, propagate this idea.
And we do share the food out amongst the crew. And if we've got a lot left over, we have a local shelter that we'll call up and they'll come around and pick the stuff up and take it away.
I mean, do you say, oh, we have a whole Tuscan vista for you to eat tonight?
Yes, come and gorge yourself on Tuscany.
Actually, speaking of the amazing Tuscan landscapes, and actually the Chinese landscape that you did too, using both Tuscan elements in the Tuscan one and, like, you know, goji berries and fortune cookies in the other. Have you traveled to Tuscany? Have you traveled to China?
Yeah. No, I mean, I love Italy. I love Italian cooking. It's my favorite. I think if I was ever to sort of, you know, choose a place to go and live, it would be Italy. I love the people, the history, the landscape, and the food is just stunning. From their cheeses, their meats, the pasta, it's all beautiful. I've been to Tuscany, and I've places like San Gimignano, which I think the Tuscan landscape is very similar to that looking sort of hilltop town.
I mean, yeah, the light quality in this book, you have to see it. Carl uses a mix of both tungsten and strobe light, but it creates, if you've ever been to Tuscany, that glow that is just, you know, so inherent of that countryside.
Yeah, the observation of light is very important. And being as a photographer, I did a lot of landscape work and a lot of studio still life work. So it's a kind of a marriage between being able to replicate sunlight in the studio and my knowledge of composition of traditional landscape photography mixed with food and still life photography to create these works.
Listen, well, I'm starved. I'm absolutely famished by talking about your beautiful book. If you haven't picked it up, it's called Food Landscapes, Carl Warner's Food Landscapes by Abrams. You can find it, you know, anywhere, everywhere, all about. Check it out. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
I'm telling you, completely inspirational and completely pangs of hunger set in right now. I'd like to thank Fairway, our sponsor again, Jack Inslee, our producer, Nat Wiener, our engineer, and Heritage Radio Network for hosting the food scene. Hope to have you here next week, Tuesday, 3 p.m. Cheers.